I work for a government agency. Always looking for good, enthusiastic men to help us carry out our directives.
You're telling me that there is a movie company in Hollywood right now that is funded by the CIA?
I think probably Hollywood is full of CIA agents, and we just don't know it.
I mean, can you ever really trust another human being? No, the answer is you cannot.
Either very smart or incredibly stupid.
Test. Everything's a test, remember?
Nothing is what it seems.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the CIA in Hollywood. I'm Tom Secker of SpyCulture.com.
And I'm Pierce Redman of PorkinsPolicyReview.com. And this is Episode 7, The CIA and Argo.
So today we're going to be looking at the 2012 Oscar-winning historical spy thriller Argo, starring Ben Affleck, and more of Ben Affleck, and yet more of Ben Affleck, and some other people, including Bryan Cranston. And of course, the film was directed by Ben Affleck, and it was produced by George Clooney and Grant Heslov. And it tells the story of a CIA exfiltration operation, where they rescued six embassy officials who were trapped in Tehran in the middle of the Iranian Revolution. And Affleck plays Tony Mendez, a CIA agent who, with the help of a Hollywood special effects wizard, I guess, sets up this fake Hollywood production company to provide cover for the operation. And, of course, the real movie's title, Argo, is the name of the movie they are pretending to be making in order to create the opportunity to sneak the six out of Iran under the guise of being a film crew. And, Piers, I think it's fair to say neither of us particularly like Argo.
No.
I've described it before as Ben Affleck having a staring competition with himself.
Yeah. And
I think one of its problems is that it's trying to be multiple things at once. It's like, it's a Hollywood satire that isn't particularly satirical. It's a historical drama that isn't very dramatic. And it's a spy thriller that's a bit short on spies and isn't very thrilling. So, I mean, I don't really like Ben Affleck as an actor. I never have. With the one exception, actually, of his minor role in Dazed and Confused. I did quite enjoy that. But
yes, actually, yeah.
But I was never going to like this film, and I guess nor were you, were you?
No, I'd have to say this is probably my least favorite film of the season. I even enjoyed Charlie Wilson's War a little bit more because there are some quite funny parts in that movie. But yeah, I mean, this is a profoundly mediocre film, and that's perhaps even giving it a little bit too much praise. it's pretty boring. For this exciting story, not a lot happens. It is a lot of Ben Affleck staring into the camera. There's nothing all that funny about it. There's not a whole lot going on. And, you know, as a historical film, it's pretty historically inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And I would just sort of echo everything that you were just saying about this film. There's no one character that you even really get to know. You have no real idea who Tony Mendez is. This is the CIA officer that Ben Affleck is playing. You hardly get to know the embassy staff that is hiding out. The Canadian ambassador, Ken Taylor, you could substitute him for anything. He really serves next to no purpose other than just it's his house that they're all in, which is, we'll get into, is very inaccurate. So yeah, it's the sort of perfect Hollywood movie because it's this basically one-dimensional piece of shit with a fun-loving image of the CIA. So what's not to like for Hollywood and the CIA in this sense? And I think, as we'll see, it follows another interesting pattern of CIA-sponsored films that get all of this praise and Oscars and whatnot. But apologies to all the listeners for having to watch this movie. It isn't that long, though, so, you know, you can just sort of get through it. But I would say maybe pour yourself a drink or something, because you'll need it.
I think that's a pretty fair summary. To be honest, I mean, I didn't think it was as bad as The Good Shepherd, but along similar lines, to be fair, and suffers from very similar problems. So, yeah, actually very comparable films in lots of right ways. But, like you said, this is a CIA-sponsored film, of course, and it's a bit pointless making this argument because it's so obvious. It's a bit like me trying to convince you that I'm waving my hand in front of my face right now. I mean, you can't see me doing it, but I absolutely assure you I am doing it right now, and I absolutely assure you this is a CIA-sponsored film. But Just for example, the CIA's entertainment liaison website includes suggestions for stories that they would like to be adapted into TV or film projects, and for quite a while in the 2000s, Argo was listed among those suggestions. So, there you have it. But, you know, also, the film is largely based on the accounts of Tony Mendez and his wife, Jonna Mendez, both of whom were consultants on the film. Tony Mendez did interviews with Ben Affleck to promote the film, and the film was allowed to shoot at Langley quite extensively. And in fact, one just interesting little point on that, Affleck mentions in the DVD commentary that they had to digitally remove the, like, swipe card entrance gates, you know, the ones that we saw in The Recruit and what have you, because obviously they weren't there back in 1980, so in order to maintain historical accuracy, which apparently was so important to him, they had to digitally, you know, computer generate the gates out of there, which I find kind of odd and quite interesting. I did think that was a very... in a very otherwise very boring DVD commentary, that was one of the few little interesting bits, that they were added after 9/11, and so therefore they weren't there in 1980 and had to be, you know, bleeped out of the video. But Pierce, I think the really interesting part of the tale of the background to this movie and how it came to become a movie is this story of the Wired article that kind of helped to bring this to a wider audience, and it helped eventually get this turned into a film. And obviously the production company that picked up on this Wired article and acquired the script and everything. So please, outline that for us.
Yeah, that is a really interesting, as you were saying, it's a really interesting history. And there's a couple bizarre characters that are involved in this. To go a little bit back, in 1997, the CIA turned 50. You know, as Tony Mendez will point out, anytime you put him in front of a camera, they did something very counterculture. His words for them, and they hired a publicist. You know, I doubt this is the first time the CIA has used PR person. But anyway, they wanted to celebrate 50 years with 50 trailblazers, as they called them. And these were supposed to be, you know, wonderful people at the CIA. If you go through that list, what we'll provide in the show notes, most of them are pretty horrible, despicable people. I believe Richard Helms is on that list. You know, Alan Dulles, a whole bunch of unsavory characters. But Tony Mendez was one of these people. So in 97, 98, his file is declassified, and Argo, the story of this operation, is you know, open to the public or whatever. Well, so then we come to a man called David Kluwans. I know I'm pronouncing that wrong, but he is the so-called executive producer of Argo. And I say so-called because he seems to have virtually no career in Hollywood at all. In one of the little special features that we'll include, he talks about how he spends all of his time scouring libraries and magazines and universities and bizarre things, looking for strange and unusual stories that are, you know, riveting. And some of these are such luminary classics such as Hot in 2000, which has no description on IMDb. There's just a picture of a surfer on it. Atomic Twister, which was in 2002, which, yes, is about tornadoes causing a nuclear meltdown, and among other people stars Zach from Saved by the Bell. Then he,
not then the he first produced... Saved by the Bell connection in this series.
Yeah, right, yes, actually, you're right, yeah.
Carry on, sorry.
Then he produced a 2002 documentary called Tog Bay, which is about a unemployed white Dutchman who is declared the reincarnation of an African king. And then he went on to create, to produce, Nacho Libre. That is it. That is his sole entire existence in Hollywood. These three crappy films that no one's ever heard of, and Nacho Libre, which was quite big, but certainly not, you know, I don't know, that fascinating.
And certainly then not a film that you would think would kind of qualify him to make Argo. I mean, what's the connection between making those sorts of films and making Argo? It doesn't really make a huge amount of sense, does it?
No, not at all. And this is why, I mean, I said the so-called executive producer. I would assume that David Kluwans is some kind of CIA person, and that these earlier films were, and this is, you know, my speculation, but that these earlier films were really just an attempt to, you know, create a sort of resume for him. But then he says that sometime around 1999, he's on the CIA's website looking at studies in intelligence, which is a journal that the CIA publishes, and we've talked about that, I believe, during The Good Shepherd. But anyway, he's on the CIA website, and he discovers this story of Argo, and he reads Tony Mendez's own article that he contributed to in Studies in Intelligence. He thinks that this is amazing, blah, blah, blah. He ends up contacting Mendez and gets his blessing to do this. Now, for whatever reason, no studio wants to pick this up, and the movie just sort of languishes. Then in 2006, and these are in his own words, he said that, you know, using the same sort of thing that Tony Mendez does, in the film Argo and in, supposedly in the operation, Mendez actually planted fake stories about the production of this film in Variety and Hollywood Reporter in order to create, you know, this cover story and to get people in Hollywood to at least know that this movie was in the works or whatever. So in 2006, Klawans decides to plant the Argo story himself. And he approaches Joshua Bierman, and they write this. He writes this article for Wired magazine. Now, Bierman seems to, at least in one of these little special features, Argo Declassified, he seems to know Klawans from something else. And it's interesting that they pick Wired for a variety of reasons. While Wired might have this reputation as being really cool and cutting edge, this story, and more specifically, the Edward Snowden Hawaii story, which we won't get into, both of these were in Wired magazines, and both of these basically created these official narratives for what happened. So Wired is an interesting magazine. But as I said, with Joshua Bierman, nothing in his resume would really strike you as the kind of person that would write this story. But he did previously write two pieces for the Believer magazine that revolved around DARPA projects, one for the Air Force and one for the Army. So that's a sort of interesting little nugget there. But anyway, Bierman writes this article, suddenly it becomes, you know, huge, a big success. And around that time, 2007, George Clooney and Grant Heslov are forming their production company, Smokehouse Pictures, and they say that this is the very first movie that they ever acquired. So they bought it up immediately. Of course, Clooney and Heslov are certainly connected to this CIA Hollywood cabal in more ways than one, but anyway, it takes them about 6 years to actually end up making this movie. And in the meantime, of course, they produce The Men Who Stare at Goats, starring George Clooney and directed by Grant Heslov, of course, dealing with the more bizarre programs that the DOD and CIA have been involved in, including psychic warfare. They create this movie. It becomes this huge success. Flesh that out a little bit, they hire Chris Terrio to write it, a man, again, with virtually no experience whatsoever as a Hollywood writer. He had worked, you know, doing sort of various different production things as PA and I believe a boom operator at one point. And he had written two small films, but nothing on the scale of this massive Hollywood film. So again, very interesting, these people with, you know, no background whatsoever, being given millions upon millions of dollars to create this massive, big CIA production. And just a quick note, Chris Terrio, who did win an Oscar for writing this piece of crap, is now set to, or he's already written or contributed to the new Batman vs. Superman movie, which has Ben Affleck as Batman, and interestingly enough, Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor. So I guess, he goes from Mark Zuckerberg to Lex Luthor, so that's pretty interesting. Yeah, and just one more quick little note that I think the listeners will find interesting. So Smokehouse Pictures, Clooney and Heslov's production company, they are set right now to produce Our Brand is Crisis. This is a Hollywood film based on the documentary Our Brand is Crisis. And for anyone that doesn't know, this is about the 2002 Bolivian presidential election, where Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada hired James Carville to basically help him beat out Evo Morales for the Bolivian presidential election. And Smokehouse Pictures is producing this in participation with Participant Media. So, there we go again. And this is definitely the type of movie that Participant would be interested in. So that's sort of the kind of history. So, just the things to take away from this are, We've got this mysterious executive producer who's done really nothing, who discovers randomly this story on the CIA's website. And then he, you know, and then this is acquired by a production company that's done nothing, Clooney and Hesloff. They hire this writer who has, you know, no experience as, you know, producer or writing a massive Hollywood movie. And it becomes this massive, huge success. So very curious set of characters there. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly what to make of it, but I would definitely say my money is that David Kloan is some kind of agent or asset who is, I don't know, I mean, he just sort of pops up out of nowhere, you know, wants to do Argo, and then boom, it happens. So there you go.
Well, and one thing I'm wondering about now, you mentioned this guy, Chris Terrio, who, from the interviews with him, he comes across to me like someone who's ex-military or... I don't know, that's just the impression I got. I could be completely wrong about that. But... given that this was Clooney and Hesloff, right, who it was their production company who were looking for a screenwriter, and we know from Hollywood Reporter type websites from that kind of period that that same production company, Clooney and Hesloff, was working on a story about Osama bin Laden's driver, his chauffeur, yes. And it was due to star Matt Damon, who else? And it was being written by none other than Aaron Sorkin, who we discussed in the last two episodes. And this was circa 2008, 2009, 2010. So this would have been in the same period that they were hiring Chris Terrio to write Argo. Why didn't they hire Aaron Sorkin?
I have no idea. That's an interesting... I mean, I want to say that maybe Sorkin had some sort... You know, the obvious answer that he was busy with something else.
The Social Network? Well, he was, but that was the only other thing he was writing at the time. I mean, the guy, you know, he can write more than one movie every 3 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and they already had a relationship with him. It just doesn't make sense to me that they would go out and get this Chris Terrio guy who no one seems to have ever heard of before, or at least certainly wasn't anywhere near as established a writer as Sorkin. And Sorkin had also already, by that point, made Charlie Wilson's War. So he'd made a successful, you know, CIA... comedic type movie, the sort of movie that they were looking to make. So it just strikes me as odd, and all the more suspicious about Chris Terrio himself.
Oh, without a doubt. And again, I mean, why, I'm not sure why David Kloan's approached Joshua Bierman. I mean, he also doesn't seem, you know, and it's funny, in the Argo Declassified, you know, Bierman says, oh, well, you know, David knew that I'm into, you know, narrative structures and a true story, blah, blah, blah. If you look at the articles he wrote prior to that, I mean, there's like nothing at all that would point you to think that he would be the right candidate to write this sort of action-packed thriller type story. So all of these characters are extremely odd and bizarre, and you know, they've all sort of coalesced together around this this project known as Argo.
Yeah, sure. And like we say, although it's really obvious and there's lots of evidence that this is a CIA-sponsored production, including Affleck jokingly admitting to being a CIA agent and things like that, there are still certainly some mysteries, aren't there? There are some very odd characters floating around in the background of this movie who we can only assume have some kind of CIA connection. But yeah, I think we should move on to the movie itself, because as terrible as the film is, we have to address it, at least for a little while. and the beginning of the film is really quite interesting to me, because you have this animated sequence that outlines, at least to some extent, the 1953 CIA coup in Iran, where Mossadegh was toppled and the Shah was re-established. And my question is why include this? Because Affleck says, not that we should take him seriously, but Affleck says that he included it so that people would be able to understand everything in its proper context, so that people would have a context in which to see this, you know, explosive beginning of the kind of riot at the embassy. But given that this whole movie is a celebration of a CIA covert op, just like Charlie Wilson's War is, I think the CIA probably would have been quite happy for this sequence to be included. And they must have been, because it's in the film. They must have at least tolerated it. But I was just wondering, is this more of, you know, promoting the cult of revolution, or at least more of the CIA promoting their own black operations? What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think actually that the sort of idea that we've talked about before about how much the CIA loves revolution, I think that's an excellent parallel to draw with the opening of this. And, you know, without getting too deep into the geopolitics of Iran in the late 70s, I certainly believe that while the CIA may not have been happy with the revolution, they certainly wanted to benefit as much as they could from it, and certainly poked and prodded certain sections and factions of that so that they could, you know, have a favorable outcome. But yeah, I mean, I almost saw that as just the kind of like throwaway, you know, yeah, see, this sort of stuff happened. Don't look too closely at it. Here's an animated feature, which of course I think just because of the series, I immediately thought of Animal Farm, our first movie. So interesting that they would pick animation to describe this. I think, again, to go back to the first episode, I think it sort of disarms you a little bit, sort of makes it more palatable. It's very easy to, you know, to see an animated version of torture, per se, as opposed to the actual, you know, Savak and some of these horrible groups that were working in Iran. So I feel like it just sort of their attempt to be like, oh, yeah, I mean, we touched on that. You know, of course, I mean, it's not really the focus of the story. Is really all about how wonderful we are and how we got out these six embassy officials. And again, calling them diplomats is sort of a stretch. You know, two of them more or less like secretaries, you know, not to put down anybody, but these were not like, you know, the ambassador to Iran or whatever. So yeah, I think it's just their sort of simple way of saying that we've covered our asses on the quote history of what happened. And of course, it's funny, you know, they mention how horrible the Savak was, but they don't mention that the CIA created and trained them completely. You know, they mention the Shah's modernization program, but they fail to mention that didn't really extend to anybody that didn't live in Tehran and was already part of the sort of Western European clique. So, you know, for instance, I mean, once you got outside of Tehran, I mean, the literacy rate was non-existent, medical care was horrible, you know, all sorts of things. And then, of course, they just sort of go into the, you know, that scene just leads right into these stark, raving, mad religious fanatics with guns. Of course, leaving out the fact that, you know, leftists were involved in this. Moderates, business leaders, basically the entire population of Iran was involved in the what became known as the Islamic Revolution. You know, again, it's just sort of picking and choosing the little history things so that then they can basically be like, okay, well, that's it. We don't need to really provide any more context. We don't need to explain, you know, that we basically not invented the Shah, but essentially turned him into this, you know, brutal, horrible dictator. We don't really need to get into the specifics that other people were involved in this revolution outside of the quote-unquote stark, raving, mad, you know, Islamists that certainly were involved. So yeah, I think it's just them kind of covering their asses so that if someone complained, they can point to this 30-second scene in the beginning of the film. And of course, they never ever really return to that again. I think there's one line when the embassy officials first escape where they sort of allude to the fact that, well, you know, we kind of caused this. And I believe it's the character Cora Legic who says this, and then she sort of shouted down, you know, and they're sort of, oh no, they're all crazy. So that's about it. There's really no more historical context given or geopolitical context. You know, we talked most recently with Sibel about in Charlie Wilson's War. I mean, you never have any sense of what's going on outside of this, you know, house in Tehran.
It's a very narrow set of events that they're portraying you. It's almost a contextless set of events. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, you know, just next door, we have the Soviet-Afghan War. I mean, there was about a million different conflicts going on. Lebanon and Syria and all sorts of other things were happening around this. Not to mention, of course, you know, Iran-Contra and, you know, all the stuff in Africa. But anyway, it's basically, I think, just the CIA's attempt to sort of say that, oh, we covered it. That's okay. Now move on. Because really what the story is about is how great we are and how we can do good things if we put our mind to it. And they can be fun, too, and sexy, and Hollywood can be involved. And that's about it. And I think that's really at the heart of this movie is to basically make the point that the CIA does good things all the time. You just don't know about it. You know, you only know about it when they decide to make a Hollywood film about it and tell the entire fucking world. But, you know, before that, oh, they're doing all these wonderful things. And again, this sort of harkens back to something that is repeated many times in this film and in many of the other films we've chosen for this season, that the CIA's mistakes are known, but their successes are unknown. So I think that's what the history is. And I don't know, I'll throw it back to you, Tom, because I'm kind of going off on a tangent.
No, sure. But you're absolutely right that it is playing very, very much into that logic. And it is in so many ways, it's a very similar film to Charlie Wilson's War. But the thing is, you could watch those two movies and not realize for one moment that these events that you're watching, in as much as any of them are true, are taking place at the same time, pretty much, yes, right next door to one another, geographically. Because both of them are so context-free that you would never make that connection unless you actually sat down and looked at a map, or obviously, you know, knew it already, realized it already. But I'm talking about for people who've just gone to watch a movie in the cinema and don't really, you know, have never looked at a map of the Middle East, for example. Yeah, they could see those two films and not realize there's any connection between them. And just think, oh, this is just two little episodes in the history of the CIA that don't really have anything to do right. with each other, rather than are part of a much bigger picture. But you touched upon it there. I mean, we can compare this film to Tony Mendez's, if you like, the official history of the Argo operation that was published by the Center for Studies in Intelligence in that journal that you mentioned. And we can compare it in two different ways. There's stuff that they added in, and there's stuff that they took out. Just like Charlie Wilson's War. And the particular thing that they really, really added in, so bloody obvious in this film, are the extra sequences of real bad Arabs. Mm. And for those of you who don't know what I mean by the phrase real bad Arabs, you really need to see the documentary by that name, and the word real is like a film reel. But that's, I think, probably the most important element in the whole film, that they just seem to have fabricated. And this is bizarre for all sorts of reasons, because, I mean, there's two sequences in particular I'm thinking of. There's the sequence in the marketplace where they go out and are pretending to be on a film scouting mission to try and, you know, give credence to this cover story, and it ends up in basically a riot for no apparent reason at all, really. And there's the sequence at the end with the airport where you have the, you know, Revolutionary Guard chasing this aeroplane down the tarmac, shooting at it, as though they're completely unconcerned that this plane, you know, could explode and maybe kill 600 people. No, 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 nasty Americans, fire, fire, fire. And the really absurd thing about all of this is that Iran's population is about 2% Arabs.
Mm.
The vast majority of people there are Persian, of course. And this, of course, means that given the number of Arabs that are portrayed in Argo, that must be pretty much all of the Arabs in Iran that appear in the film, since all of the Iranians we see, pretty much, are Arabs. And so I would say that actually the racism in this film, and this film is racist in some ways, I'd say it's actually directed towards Arabs rather than primarily towards Iranians. Would you agree with that? Or?
Sure. I mean, there's a, if you aren't aware, there's a massive, massive Iranian population in Hollywood. You know, and there's even some references to that in this movie. Probably one of the most overt racist references to Iranians in this movie is when John Goodman, who plays this John Chambers, this famous Hollywood makeup artist and CIA agent, he basically is talking about how, oh, we've got to be quiet about what's going on because the, quote, Khomeiniacs are Fruit Loops, but they got cousins who sell prayer rugs and 8-tracks on La Brea, implying that all of the Iranians, you know, out on Hollywood Boulevard are spies. I'm not sure. But yeah, I would say definitely that the sort of depiction of real bad Arabs, that is the where it really gets racist. And that's interesting, again, I think for a variety of reasons. I think one that, you know, while there's a lot of rhetoric going on about how evil the Iranians are, we would certainly like to, you know, rekindle the kind of relationship that we had under the Shah. So yeah, it is interesting that the sort of most violent depictions of the Iranians in this are that cliched real bad Arab character, where they're basically just screaming at the top of their lungs. They're not making any sense. They hate women. That is the kind of a depiction. So I think that is, again, really interesting. And I think, you know, for all of this rhetoric, again, about how evil Iran is, I think we're much more concerned with destroying the Arab world, because we seem to I'm laughing, but this is very serious. I mean, we're in Yemen right now. We're in Syria, Libya, Iraq. I mean, name a country. So I think we're much more concerned with destroying the Arab world. So, again, yeah, it's really interesting. And that wasn't something that I had initially picked up on.
Well, and I do wonder, you know, I mean, you're right. They do characterize them as basically they're brown, they've got beards, and they're angry, and they're shouting. Mm. And I do wonder, you know, the context for all of this. This film was released in 2012, and if you think that's kind of just at the end of what was laughably termed the Arab Spring. And mm-hmm. so for the previous maybe 3 years, what was the depiction of Arabs that we'd seen on television? You turned on any news channel, it was a crowd of Arabs shouting, getting angry about something, and then you get this, which is,
yeah,
you know, just the same sort of thing all over again. And this is, you know, codifying the notion of, oh, well, this is the historical revolution that was like that, a revolution in Egypt or Tunisia or wherever it is that you want to talk about in the modern day. And just the coinciding of those two things, I doubt, was a coincidence. But also I wonder, oh, it makes me laugh, you know. Affleck loves going on these talk shows and sort of saying, you know, speaking out against anti-Islamic racism,
oh, yeah,
for example, and making himself appear like, you know, a proper, well-adjusted Hollywood liberal who isn't at all prejudiced about anything. And yet he then presides over this absolutely laughably inaccurate racist movie. And it's not like the racism's the main point of this movie by any means, but it is there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just because it's so hysterically inaccurate that he doesn't even seem to have realized that he's made a film where all of his antagonists are just shouty Arabs in a film in a country that only has 2% Arab people.
Mm.
He doesn't even seem to know that. So this is just symbolic of the wider attitude he seems to have had, and everyone on this film seems to have had, towards historical accuracy. And I think that's the more important element, is that, like I say, if we compare the CIA's own history of the Argo operation with the film, which is what you've done and what I've done. I mean, you came up with several very, very interesting inaccuracies and omissions, so please get into some of them.
Yeah, there's probably too many to list, yeah, all of. And this is what's so amazing. This is such a familiar tactic with the CIA when they get involved in these movies. The movies that are dealing with historical things, it's just they seem to lie about nearly everything. And this seems to be a general tactic. And I believe it was even recently, there was some document that came to light talking about Gary Webb. And it was like a CIA internal memo where they were basically telling people, just keep lying about everything. You know, just keep lying about everything that Webb is saying, and eventually it won't really matter anymore. And if you throw in enough little truths here and there, that doesn't really matter. Then the lies and the truth mean nothing. And this seems to be what they did in this movie. So, I mean, first off, the biggest lie is how influential the CIA really was in this operation. In reality, this entire thing was planned out by Canada. Canada provided the passports, they provided the credit cards, they provided all the sort of documentation that you see, you know, Ben Affleck laboring over constantly in the film. And this is to the point that Ken Taylor, the real Ken Taylor, got so incensed when he went to the premiere of this movie, I believe in Toronto, that he basically, Ben Affleck was so embarrassed by this that Ben Affleck actually changed the postscript in the end of the film to make Canada seem more involved, because I think originally the postscript was basically like, oh, you know, Ken Taylor was took too much credit, but that's, you know, he was just a good soldier, you know, he's a good CIA asset, so that's why, you know, Ken Taylor talked about how great he was and that really he did nothing, you know, he was insignificant. Whereas again, I mean, you never really get the sense, but these officials were living with Ken Taylor and actually another Canadian embassy official. They were in two separate houses for months. Mendez was there for like a day and a half. You know, granted, yes, he did get them out, but that's, you know, the Canada really went out on a limb here. And even Jimmy Carter, who was featured at the end of the film and you know, absolutely loved this. Before the movie came out, he said, oh, it deserves an Academy Award, blah, blah, blah. And he told Piers Morgan 90%, quote, 90% of the contributions to the ideas and the consummation of the plan was Canadian. The movie gives almost full credit to the American and CIA. And with that exception, the movie's really, you know, really very good. So very, you know, that's really interesting. And I mean, of course, the CIA is going to take as much credit as they would, you know, they'd like to. But and then there's just like weird little inaccuracies that seem to make no sense at all. You know, like, for instance, there's a line at the beginning where Bryan Cranston is, they're trying to figure out what's going on. And they say, oh, well, you know, they're in the Canadian ambassadors. You know, they tried to go to the British and the New Zealanders, and they threw them out. They said, no way. This never happened. And again, both British and New Zealand officials were really pissed off about this. And in fact, the British took them in at great risk. The British were not well liked whatsoever in Iran. As you know, they were very instrumental in helping the CIA overthrow Mossadegh. So you know, very dangerous for these officials. And then they helped move them to the Canadians. In fact, and the New Zealand. The New Zealand ambassador to Iran, Chris Beebe, and Richard Sewell, who is the second secretary, they also did quite a bit. Beebe actually rented property as a safe house in case they were discovered and they had to run. And Sewell was actually one of the people who drove them to the airport. So it's really bizarre that they I'm not even sure why they did that. It seems unnecessary, and it seems like again, this interesting tactic with the CIA in these films where they're just sort of like, well, fuck you, you know? Like, we're just going to do whatever we want and you'll have to deal with it. You know, we're the big... Oh, no, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I just do wonder, is this a bit like with Zero Dark Thirty, where the CIA created this whole storm about whether or not they were happy over the portrayal of torture in the film, which, of course, is a nonsense. The CIA were perfectly happy with it. They were had such control over that movie, they were happy with everything in it. And maybe there's a little bit of that with this, that, you know, the part of the purpose there was to create an artificial, you know, a storm in a teacup, a fuss about nothing, because ultimately this is something that happened 30 years before the movie was made. So, yeah, okay, you're going to get a few officials saying a few things and getting a bit narky about it, but the sum total of that will be what? Nothing very consequential. But what it does is help distract everyone from any more serious discussion that they could have about the movie and what it's really doing. To create a storm in a teacup, and I suppose also to raise the profile of the movie, perhaps. It creates a little bit of controversy and some headlines, and maybe so so even if they weren't trying to distract people from anything, maybe they were just trying to, yeah, create a bit of a story for themselves to further promote this otherwise, like you say, such a mediocre film. But please, carry on with the inaccuracies in it. I was just floating
an
idea.
No, I mean, just sort of piggybacking on that, I think this is also a great way for the CIA to be like, oh, you see? I mean, they fucked up. They got things wrong all the time, you know, and to sort of distance themselves, to say, yes, we were involved, but obviously we weren't that involved because look at all these inaccuracies. You know, we never said anything bad about the Kiwis or the British. You know, they're our buddies. And in fact, the CIA's Twitter account at the time was like tweeting out all of the historical inaccuracies. So, again, I think you're right in that this deflects criticism away from them. You know, it puts it on Affleck, and he can take the blame, and obviously he's fine with taking one for the team. As I said, he met with Ken Taylor and apologized and was like, you know, oh, please forgive me, I'll change the postscript, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, those are, and there's a few more sort of major inaccuracies, and then a few little random ones that make no sense. The biggest one is, of course, how big a threat was this when they were in the airport, when they were moving around? Because in the film, it's you're made to believe that they're never allowed to leave Taylor's residence. Now, in reality, they were actually in two different residences. I think it was four in Ken Taylor's and two in another embassy official's house. They met constantly. They were driving around Tehran. They would have these big dinners. I mean, they were there for months on end. They were moving around. There wasn't that much of a fear, at least then, that they could at least drive from one house to the other. The other major thing is in the airport, there is this scene where a Revolutionary Guard member interrogates them. Interestingly, the actor who is the guy who's making this big fuss about it is in one of the CIA's other little pet projects, State of Affairs, which is this awful, awful show. But that Revolutionary Guard member plays this sort of Ayman al-Zawahiri character who actually in the show ends up pretending to work with the CIA only to turn around and, you know, screw them and carry out this massive terrorist attack. So, again, interesting, these people that pop up over and over again. Mm-hmm. But, again, that scene never happened. There was no problem at the airport. And, in fact, Mendes has admitted in documentaries as well as in his own writing that he had assets all over the airport looking out for him, making sure that everything was okay. They had backup tickets. They could have gotten on another plane if something happened. And perhaps the most glaring omission is that there was a second CIA agent with Mendes the entire time.
For sure.
He's codenamed Julio. Presumably, he's either still working or it needs to, you know, his identity needs to be kept a secret. But again, there were lots more people. They had assets in the airport. They weren't, I mean, Mendes has even sort of alluded to this. They weren't in that much danger when they were actually there. And again, I mean, this idea that they would blow up the plane on the tarmac or something. I mean, it would be such a scandal, you know, for the Iranians who, again, are trying to put on this good face like everything is going well. You know, they're going to blow up this Swiss airline with, you know, God only knows how many people. So, again, that's another big omission. Obviously, Ben Affleck needs to be the star and would never share the limelight with somebody else. But, you know, we can get onto that later. And then there's two sort of silly things that the film makes up for no reason at all. One of them is they show, I guess it kind of makes sense, but they show the Hollywood sign as being destroyed. That was rebuilt 2 years prior in 1978. So I guess they wanted to just show, yeah, Hollywood is gritty or whatever. And then an even more bizarre one is there is a scene with Hamilton Jordan, who was the chief of staff to President Carter, and there's a scene where you see him and someone is calling him about his kids and blah blah blah, and you know, his wife has got to pick him up or something. This never happened. He was not married at the time and he had no kids. So again, I'm not sure why they inserted that in there. It just seems like, again, one of those little inaccuracies that they can point to sort of shift your attention away. So the conversation, you know, you can have an article where they talk to Hamilton Jordan and he says, oh, well, I wasn't married at the time. I don't have kids. Not, you know, whatever else was going on at that time. And there's some other little things. I mean, they make it seem like President Carter is like holding up the money so that Mendes can buy the tickets when they're at the airport. This never happened. In fact, the Canadian ambassador Ken Taylor and his wife actually bought the tickets for them previously. And again, I mean, if you really think that President Carter, you know, while they're at the airport, while they could be, you know, murdered and hung and tortured publicly, that Carter would be like, well, hold on a second. Let me think about this operation.
Yeah, let me just look at this memo one more time.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, it's crazy. And again, that's this is something that's played up throughout the movie, this idea that the CIA is subservient to the president and to the State Department. This is over and over and over again. You know, early on, they say that there's this whole big song and dance about how the CIA is just a periphery figure in this. This is really the State Department's job, as if the State Department would have any clue as to how to do this. So, yeah, those are the major. And again, there are other little inaccuracies, but they're, you know, there's so many of them. But those are the major ones. And they're all interesting because these were outright obvious lies about people that are all still living and who have all responded to this. So that's very interesting, and I think it just sort of goes to show that even when the CIA is quote-unquote being open and, you know, discussing how great they are still lying, and this is just indicative of a intelligence organization. I mean, they're never going to tell you the truth, even when they're claiming to be doing that. So, you know, just keep that in mind, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's always a good lesson to keep in mind. I mean, just to pick up on one thing that you said there, the thing that really made me laugh in those, when the CIA's Twitter account got involved in all of this and they were starting to tweet out these inaccuracies and say, oh, well, this little bit didn't really happen like that or whatever. Then right at the end, just like with that roundtable discussion on The Good Shepherd, they turn around and say, but despite all this, we thought it was a really good movie. Thanks, Ben.
You know? Right. Yeah.
It was also childish and kind of moronic that they were... But then again, the CIA's Twitter account is a bastion of childish, moronic behavior, and well worth following because of that. The sort of stuff that comes out of there you won't find anywhere else, to be honest. But I suppose the only other question about the movie itself is, what was the purpose of this film? What was the why were they involved in doing this? Because I've said it to you before, I think this was primarily just a celebration of the CIA's relationship with Hollywood, just a kind of yeah, this is great. Look, the CIA being in Hollywood's really cool and funny and, you know, look what they can do. But I guess there are other purposes, and I know your thinking on this is a bit, perhaps a bit more subtle than mine, because I'm very flippant when it comes to this movie. But yeah, what do you think they were, the CIA's involvement in this film was all about? What was the purpose here?
Well, yeah, I think that the sort of celebratory aspect is certainly is there, and that's, there's no doubt about that. And I mean, we could just look no further than the amount of, you know, time and that Ben Affleck has spent doing these CIA DOD productions, and then, you know, the CIA gives him this big opportunity and basically helps him get an Oscar for this, you know, crap movie. So, and again, it is also this great, it's a feel-good story. The CIA saves the day. No one gets hurt. No one's killed. You can feel good about hating those evil Iranians. That's okay because they were bad. You know, so it is this very, it is a celebratory thing. But, I mean, there are some other interesting aspects. I mean, I think, again, you can't completely divorce yourself from the geopolitical aspects. Obviously, this movie is great at making that kind of subtle propaganda that's very clever, where you can watch the movie, you can pretend like Ben Affleck to be a good liberal, you know, and to want to support human rights and all these things, but you can go and see that movie and it's okay to harbor racist or unpleasant prejudices against the Iranian people. It's okay because, you know, look what happened. Look at that in the bazaar when that guy was screaming his head off, when they were banging on the windows, and oh, you know, all the women are walking around in chadors and whatnot. So, it's one of those things where it's okay to be offensive. It's all right because they're bad and the CIA is good. So I think there's that aspect as well within this movie. But, you know, other than that, I mean, I think the CIA just, I think they wanted to get involved in this because they just, they saw this great opportunity to, again, to just sort of get a great story out there for themselves. And I think it was also the way for them to, I don't know, maybe even close a chapter in their involvement within Hollywood to a degree. This was such a public display. I mean, the CIA really, I mean, Affleck in one of the documentaries about the making of, is talking about, I mean, they were just letting him run around Langley with a camera, doing whatever he wanted to.
Talking about how he met the director of the CIA, and he just walked the halls and, you know, got a sense of what it was like. And I'm thinking, did they just let people from Hollywood wander around Langley without guides or, you know, whatever? I mean, clearly they don't. So what's really going on there? You're right. Yeah.
No, and I think that might have been the thing. You know, again, we've touched on this a little bit in the season, but there are definitely hidden messages in a lot of these films, and I think perhaps one of them in this is sort of, this is it, this is the last hurrah in terms of the over-the-top sponsorship of Hollywood films. This one was so big, and I think, as we'll get onto with the Oscars, I mean, it was on a level that you wouldn't even imagine. And again, you know, just speaking of the Oscars, this movie was competing against Zero Dark Thirty, the other film that had perhaps even more unprecedented access to the CIA, and that, you know, Catherine Bigelow and Mark Boal were, I mean, they were looking, they might have even seen pictures from whatever happened in Abbottabad. So I think that this is, again, a way for the CIA to kind of send the message to those in Hollywood that this is sort of the end of that kind of relationship. We're certainly here, and we will help you out whenever you need to. And there are times when we're going to want you to help us out. But I wonder if this wasn't a sort of a one last big showy display of everything, and now it's going to go into the more sort of hidden things, like with movies like The Social Network. And of course, there are a whole bunch of movies coming out very soon that I can only imagine had complete CIA cooperation with, but it'll be in a more hidden sort of a way. And that's sort of how I see Argo and the CIA, just sort of, you know, let's have one big public thing. Let's you know, we're going to get great PR. People are going to think we're cool. You know, we're going to play up this whole James Bond aspect to all of this, and that'll be great for us. And we can kind of, you know, send the message that's sort of it. This is the last time that we're going to go to this level, but, you know, we're still there.
Possibly so. I mean, it is, because, I mean, the whole period that we've been looking at in terms of the modern day films in this series, have been, since the establishment of the CIA's Entertainment Liaison Office, most of them have been Chase Brandon movies, but some after that. And so I guess maybe that's it. Maybe there was like a cycle or a point where they thought the culmination is going to be in approximately 2012, where we're going to have these two great big CIA movies going head-to-head at the Oscars. And then it's all going to go a little bit quiet and a little bit more subversive and maybe a little bit more subtle in terms of what they're actually doing. And maybe we're not going to see quite so many. In fact, I think you're right. I think I would be surprised if we saw as many big CIA movies in the next 10 years as we saw in, say, the 10 years after 9/11. Mm. So, yeah, I could kind of buy into that. But you mentioned it yourself, the Oscars. The Oscars ceremony, which... possibly the weirdest Oscar ceremony ever, where Argo won the Academy Award for Best Picture, and that is only the start of what's strange about it. I mean, why did it win Best Picture of all the things that... I mean, why not give it a screenplay award or something, some token award? Why do you have to give it Best Picture when it really wasn't, by any means, the Best Picture? But, of course, the award was presented by Michelle Obama, the First Lady, and Affleck's acceptance speech is one of the strangest you will ever see. But, I mean, you want to break this down. I know you were watching this live on the TV as it was happening with a bunch of friends, weren't you?
Yeah, this was the last Oscars I've ever seen. And basically because it was so unsettling and bizarre that I just didn't want to watch them anymore after that. But, yeah, I mean, it's... Affleck comes up, and I mean, everyone should just go and watch this as well for themselves. But it is this bizarre thing. First, you've got Michelle Obama in the White House, right? You've got Jack Nicholson introducing her, which is odd. Then you've got this video link up of Obama, of Michelle Obama, and she's there circled by representatives from all of the armed services. So you've got the Navy, the Army, the Marines, the Air Force, whatever. They're behind her. Why? I have no idea. And then she, you know, she's, you know, listing off these films and whatnot. And you're sort of, I was sat there thinking like, is it going to be Zero Dark Thirty or is it going to be Argo? It's got to be one of the two, you know, but they seem to make such a big stink about how bad, you know, Zero Dark Thirty was so, you know, terrible a torture. And then she announces Argo. You know, and then it cuts to Ben Affleck, who sort of feigns like he's really surprised about this. Whereas, come on, I don't think, you know, Michelle Obama doesn't do the Oscars without knowing, you know, the people involved knew exactly what was going to happen. And then he comes up for what can only be characterized as the most uncomfortable, awkward speech in Oscar history. Affleck is either so incredibly nervous or so incredibly coked up to the gills that he can barely get out, you know, what he's trying to say. I mean, he rambles on about his wife, and he compares her to Iran at one point, and you know, how difficult it is working and living with her, but it's all great, it's all great. Then he goes off onto this tangent about, you know, can't hold grudges. you know, it goes on and on, and there isn't he thanks Steven Spielberg for no reason at all, because he's just sitting there. You know, he basically sounds completely insane. Like I said, I mean, when we watched it, me and my friends, we were like, he must have just, I mean, railed a gram of coke before he went up there, because there's no way he could be that nervous and uncomfortable. There's also my favorite part of this whole speech is when he's going on about you can't hold grudges, I think, the camera turns over to Jamie Foxx, and the look on his face is just, in his head, he must have been like, what the hell is this guy doing, and can someone hit the music to get him off the stage? This is like so, it's like a meltdown going on.
But the thing is, it's got, like, George Clooney and Grant Heslov are stood there right next to him, and neither of them bother to, like, interrupt or say, thanks, Ben, yeah, and I'd just like to, or whatever, you know, anything to stop this car crash. It was almost like they were stood there smirking, thinking this was hilarious, which it kind of was in a dark way, but it's, very bizarre speech.
Yeah, and again, I mean, you can only imagine that there's something in the way he's talking that leads you to think he'll never be on that stage again. You know, that this was solely, and also, I mean, this is solely the work of this nefarious agency. I mean, I don't know, Tom, I know you had some interesting thoughts on what he was saying to his wife, Jennifer Garner, and what that might mean.
Well, this is, again, speculative, and so people can take this with as much of a pinch of salt as they like. But I have floated the possibility that Jennifer Garner, Ben Affleck's wife, is actually his CIA handler. because she seems to be even more embedded with the CIA and from a longer period back than he was. And so, I mean, she did like the recruitment ad for the CIA, and she got that job because of Chase Brandon. So she goes back all the way to then. I suppose Affleck did do Summer of All Fears, but anyway, he does this bit where he's talking to his wife and he's saying, "Oh, you know, I know we've had some difficulties, but you know, you stuck by me and I've stuck by you, and we've worked through our problems and all of that." And I do just wonder, was there some kind of little falling out between Affleck and the CIA during the making of this film? I don't know what over exactly. I can't really think of which part of the film or anything. But maybe they just had a few tensions about how to shape the thing, or quite what would happen, or even whether or not Affleck would get the Best Director Oscar as well as the Best Picture Oscar. I don't know. I'm again, speculating here. And that in his saying that to his wife, which is a very, very, very strange thing to say to your wife.
Publicly, too.
Yeah, but in public, on live television, on a show that everyone's going to watch. I wonder if he was... And she seems fine with it. She's just sort of sat there smiling and waving and like, "Oh, it's okay, Ben. Yeah, don't worry." And I do just wonder, is that him sending a covert message to the CIA saying, "I know we had a bit of a falling out over this, but, you know, we're still best buds," kind of thing? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't, but... People can watch that video and obviously completely make up their own mind. But I guess we've probably stuck the boot into Argo, and particularly into Affleck, enough for one episode. So, I mean, I did want to spend just a few minutes kind of looking back on this whole first season that we've done of the CIA in Hollywood. Because I know when we started, we said we were primarily concerned with looking at the major Chase Brandon productions, and also trying to explain just how complex and how convoluted the CIA's public image is. And I feel we have done that. I hope we've done that. But is there anything you'd particularly like to emphasize or just draw out from the lengthy discussions and the episodes that we've done in this first season?
Yeah, just, I mean, just first, it's been such a pleasure doing this with you, Tom. And I can't wait for the second season. But I guess one of the major things is just, I guess I didn't realize quite how clever they are, how interested in creating art the CIA really is. And that's something that I hope comes across to the listeners, you know, after all of these episodes. I mean, for the most part, the films that we've chosen, at least for this, have all been pretty good. They've all been interesting. Or were they? And when some of them might not be totally interesting or totally your cup of tea, I think they're all really distinctive films with a distinctive feel. And
yes.
And this is something that's really interesting. You can look at the DOD's involvement or the FBI or, you know, anything like that, and the films are just, you know exactly what's going to happen. You know exactly the sort of trajectory, you know what's, you know, what the jokes are going to be, what actors are going to do this and that. Whereas with the CIA, I hope it really comes across that they are involved in a much, much deeper, powerful level at creating culture. And they understand how to adapt to current events better, I think, than anyone else in terms of crafting propaganda. They understand trends in culture. I mean, just looking at things like, you know, Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers, especially, that whole gross-out comedy thing that happened. The CIA was right there. They understood, we've got to get into this. You know, if we're going to keep doing this, we've got to be able to harness that sort of power. The same way that I think they understand in things like The Social Network, we can also make good films just in general. We can make a good artistic film. That's fine. And at the same, you know, in Enemy of the State or The Recruit, I mean, they can do action movies. They can do thrillers. They can do these sort of historical comedy dramas. And this is something that I think sort of is completely different from any other government agency that works in Hollywood. And I really think, you know, that they actually enjoy creating art. and this is a really perverse and bizarre sort of aspect, but I think it's really important. And I hope that kind of comes across, and also that it's okay to enjoy these films. I know there's a lot of people out there in the alt media who have this sort of, "Oh, if it's propaganda, then I'm not gonna read it. I'm not gonna enjoy it," anything like that. And I hope that, you know, you actually enjoy watching these films, because by and large, they're not all maybe necessarily amazing, but they're all pretty good. They're mostly all enjoyable, and there's actually a lot going on in them. There's a lot. There's deeper meaning to what the CIA is doing. You know, it's much more complex, their influence in how they create these films and how they craft things. I mean, without sort of, you know, inflating how powerful they are, I mean, they're able to create propaganda in a way that is so clever and covert that many times you're not even aware that it is affecting you. And that's a really powerful thing. And I mean, that's why I love exploring this with you, because it is something that needs to be explored more. And just one sort of final thing I think that's really interesting too is in the way that they can recreate or alter history. They can alter sort of real events like Charlie Wilson's War, like Argo, to an extent. I mean, Enemy of the State, the whole Edward Snowden thing, and we've seen this, you know, happening in some of the other films as well, that they really are able to alter our notions of what is real, what is a real event, what is reality. And really, at the basic form, this is magic. This is what magic is about. It's not about, you know, Harry Potter or whatever. It's about altering your own consciousness. And if you can do that, then you are performing a spell. And ultimately, I think that's what the CIA is doing in many of these films. They are altering our consciousness. They are changing that. And they totally understand that power and how powerful that can be. So, you know, that's sort of I hope that sort of sticks with you, and that, you know, that you're able to then, when you watch other movies that may have overt or not so overt, you know, CIA cooperation, that you're able to see that and you're able to understand that, you know, a spell might be being performed on you to alter your own reality. And that's a really powerful thing. And it's just it really amazes me the level to which the CIA is doing this in Hollywood. You know, again, DOD, FBI, you know, NSA, whatever, name a three-letter organization. Yes, they're in Hollywood as well, but it's in a really specific sort of way. They're making a war movie. They're doing this. They're doing that. You know, there's got to be a positive aspect in that film that the DOD or whatever can prop up. Whereas, again, with the CIA, they are in everything. They're in gross-out comedies. They're in thrillers. They're in artistic Hollywood films. They're in action movies. They're doing so much that, you know, I think without knowing it, I mean, so much of our culture is being created by them. And, you know, take it from Animal Farm, an animated film in the 50s, all the way up to Argo right now, where you've got this bizarre Oscar ceremony with, you know, Affleck apologizing possibly to the CIA and Michelle Obama giving him an award and all this stuff. So this is a really fascinating topic and a subject, and I hope that we've piqued your interest in this. And I hope that, you know, all the listeners, you know, go out and do their own research on this, because there's lots of stuff that me and Tom have probably missed that we couldn't get to. And, you know, I'd love for everyone to be involved in this project.
Well, for sure. And I suppose one quick question. Have you changed your mind on any of the films that we've studied? And I will say, certainly on some of them I have, and the most obvious one would probably be Charlie Wilson's War, because I have to admit, the first time I watched that film, I did kind of enjoy it quite a lot. And very much when I rewatched it recently for the episode we did the other day with Sibel, I really hated it.
Oh, yeah.
Have you changed your mind on any of the films?
Definitely. I did. I mean, the first time I saw Charlie Wilson's War when I was young with my dad, I did like it at the time. I have learned to hate it with a passion. But I think, you know, on another level, I actually really, really enjoyed The Social Network. That was probably my favorite film of this whole series. I loved the look of it. I loved the feel. I actually really enjoyed it, and I was so adamantly opposed to that. And I think I talked about that when we were talking with Thomas. And I also really enjoyed The Recruit, and that was a film that I would have never really thought about otherwise. I had sort of dismissed it out of hand as some stupid, cheesy action thriller. Whereas I think there's so much going on in that movie that is really important. So I definitely changed my mind on that. And just on another level, I mean, I've changed – all of the guests have offered such different interpretations of these films, and they've picked up on stuff that I know I didn't even – think about. You know, as much as Charlie Wilson's War sucked, I think Sibel's comments on sort of the neocon influence of the whole, this liberal progressive, you know, warmongering stuff, that's so fascinating. It was something that I never thought of, and that is across the board with all of these films. So many, you know, just little bits and pieces that were fleshed out that I had never even thought of. So, you know, my opinion on all of these films has changed quite a bit.
Well, and I'd just like to echo what you said. I'd like to thank all of the guests that we've had on this season of the CIA and Hollywood. They've all done very, very well. They have all offered something different to each other and added something that neither of us would have come up with or contributed to this. So if any or all of our guests are listening, a big thank you to all of you. And a big thank you to you, BS. You've put a huge amount of work into this series, and you've made it a whole lot more interesting and fun for me. So a big thank you to you as well. And just quickly to look at our at least penciled in sketch for season two, which you've got to understand we have been talking about, but we have not finalized by any means yet. But we're thinking in the region of, we were going to look at The Quiet American, the 1950s version, though we'll probably touch on the remake as well. We were wanting to do an episode looking at George Clooney and CBS, so that would be Good Night and Good Luck and Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. They're the films to watch for that. I'm just saying this in case people want to get ahead of the curve and rewatch some of these films before.
Yeah, no, please do. Yeah.
We're also probably going to be doing something on James Bond, probably Thunderball and Goldfinger, the 1960s James Bond films. We may not do the Jason Bourne trilogy. We certainly want to do Zero Dark Thirty, of course. And we'll probably wrap off the season, like we have with this one, with The Interview, which is a similar film to Argo, but it's a much more kind of teeny stoner dropout version of the same kind of story. But that's where we're probably going in season two. And I mean, Pierce, before we just wrap this up completely, is there anything you just want to say at the end here?
Oh, I'd like to thank you, Tom, for you know, letting me help you out with this and letting me, you know, help produce this with you. It's been such an honor, and it's just, I mean, beyond a pleasure. I am sort of looking forward to not having to worry about, you know, Hollywood and the CIA, but I am also really excited for the second season of this as well. So I just want to thank you so much for everything that you've done, and this has just been beyond a pleasure and fun and exciting. And again, just to thank everybody, Aaron Franz, Guillermo Jimenez, Adam, Sabelle Edmonds, Thomas Sheridan, everybody that helped, you know, with this series, and just every episode has been so great.
Well, yeah, and to everyone else who's joined us for this series, I really hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've learned from it, obviously, but I also really hope you've enjoyed it. And of course, me and Pierce, we welcome your feedback on this. I'm at spyculture.com. You can find the contact page on spyculture.com/contact. And Pierce is at porkinspolicyreview.com, so you can email him there or leave a comment on his site. And so I suppose all that's left to say is thank you for taking the time, and please do join us again relatively soon for the next season of the CIA and Hollywood.